From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. You're listening to Idaho Matters. It's Friday, which means it's our reporter roundtable. We're going to get you updated on all of the news that made headlines this last week. A lot to get to today. Our panel includes Clark Corbin with Idaho Capital Sun, Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with Idaho Statesman, Gretchen Parsons, managing editor with BoiseDev.com, Sadie Dittenberg, reporter with Idaho Ed News, Will Walkie, reporter for the Mountain West News Bureau and Wyoming Public Media. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday, Gemma.
Thanks for having me.
So, absolutely. So, lots of news coming out of the state house this week. And so, Clark, I want to begin there. And this is some modifications that have now been made in regards to anyone under the age of 18 testifying at the legislature. Can you start with how this all began and where it is now?
Yeah, for sure. One of the big fights that we are seeing in the Idaho legislature as the first month really comes to a close is this debate over youth testimony. At one point, two different committees in the Idaho House of Representatives had announced bans on allowing anyone under the age of 18 to come forth and testify during public hearings of their committee meetings. That was the House Judiciary Rules and Administration Committee. That's Representative Bruce Gogg's committee. That was the first committee to announce that ban. And then the second, which happened last week, was the House Local Government Committee, which is chaired by Representative Barb Ehart, a Republican from Idaho Falls. There was immediately a pushback from young people, but not just young people. Also, the Meridian City Council and Mayor of Meridian wrote a letter to Chairman Skog and said, we think that it's important to listen to youth voices and to include youth voices. Last week, about 30 young students from area high schools, many of them affiliated with the nonpartisan group Babe Vote, which encourages young people to vote. About 30 young people affiliated with that group attended the House Judiciary Rules and Administration Committee. And as they were looking on from the audience, Chairman Skog announced that he was going to make a change to his ban on youth testimony, to where he would allow young people to testify, but they would either need to be accompanied by a parent or guardian or have a specific form filled out, like a parent's permission slip. And so he made that change. He said, we're not going to ban anyone from testifying based on their age, but if they're under 18, I want to get their parents' permission. And I talked to a number of the students who came out after the meeting ended. Many of them said they were really grateful that Representative Skog modified his rule, but they were still concerned that the parental permission could be a barrier. And these young people talked about how the Idaho legislature isn't shy about taking up bills and legislation that would change what they're taught in school, would change which activities they are and are not allowed to participate in, which would affect their gender identity and their reproductive rights. And so they talked about how, you know, the legislature passes all these bills related to young people, and young people should have a voice in the conversation and needed to be included for those reasons. But they're concerned that the parental permission slip could be a barrier, either if the kids don't access the proper form, or some people talk to me about maybe members of the LGBTQ community would have parents who aren't supportive of them and don't want to support them speaking out at the state house. And so that could be the barrier there. So one committee has changed its rules. The second committee, Representative Ehart's committee, I met with her yesterday afternoon after a long committee hearing at the Idaho State Capitol. She said she's making no changes to her rules, which prohibited testimony from anyone under 18 unless they're specifically invited by a legislator serving on the committee or have the advance permission of Chairwoman Ehart. And so that's kind of where things stand. But it has been one of the big debates thus far in the first month of the session, but not the only debate, as we'll get into, I'm sure, this hour.
Oh, yeah, not the only one for sure. So, Scott, there is a push in the legislature to eliminate marriage license in the state of Idaho. Now, opponents are saying that this is targeting gay marriage. Can you explain this?
Yeah, so this is Senator Scott Herndon from North Idaho, who has proposed a bill to eliminate marriage licenses in Idaho. And he, when he was presenting the bill, he said up front, you know, I will just tell the committee right away that we're not changing anything about the qualifications, who marries, This legislation actually has no political motivation. And Senator Melissa Wintrow really, you know, wanted to ask him specifically if this has anything to do with outlawing gay marriage. And he said, no, it doesn't. However, there are some telling signs that suggest that it has might have something to do with gay marriage. First of all, Senator Herndon is a gay marriage opponent. He has said in his campaign and before the session that he wants to defend, quote unquote, defend traditional marriage. And an early iteration of his bill, a description of his bill on the agenda for the committee, said that this legislation eliminates the marriage license. Marriage in Idaho will consist of a man and a woman meeting legal qualifications. And then that was removed from the agenda. And then the bill came back up again on another committee agenda a couple of days later, removing that reference to a man and a woman. And so, you know, one must, you know, come to the conclusion that clearly his original intent was to somehow define marriages between a man and a woman. Now, how that would happen, it's really unclear. It's a kind of a complicated bill. It removes the state government from the process of issuing marriage licenses and returns it to county governments where it would be a certificate. How that would be some way as a mechanism to ban gay marriage, it's not clear, but one could conceive of, you know, we have a attorney general now, Raul Labrador, who has made it clear that he intends to be a politically active and activist attorney general. One could see that this bill could be, if passed, could be used somehow to challenge gay marriage ruling. And, you know, the Supreme Court has shown a proclivity for shooting down the fundamental right of privacy, as we saw in the Dobbs decision with regard to abortion. And at least one U.S. Supreme Court justice has suggested that they should take a look at other rulings, including Obergefell, which solemnized gay marriage in the United States. So we'll have to see. The bill has been referred to Senate State Affairs, where it seems to be sitting, and we might not see that come back this session. Who knows? But it's something that we'll definitely be keeping an eye on because it's an important issue for a lot of Idahoans.
Mm-hmm. So, Sadie, the new superintendent for public instruction, Debbie Critchfield, is asking the legislature for more money when it comes to career technical education. So what exactly is she asking for?
Yeah, so Debbie Critchfield's, one of her top priorities throughout her campaign and throughout her now term in office has been career technical education. And she is, she believes that with the $52.4 million allocated for discretionary funding, she believes that there's an opportunity for lawmakers to create more opportunities in the career technical education realm. So as of now, the state gets $8 million of federal CTE funding, and only 20 of Idaho's 115 school districts apply for that federal funding because it's, as she said, cumbersome and onerous. And a lot of that ends up in Southwest Idaho. So she really wants to broaden the CTE funding throughout the state, and she wants to create more opportunities and reduce barriers for districts to apply for some of that funding.
Okay. Gretchen, I want to leave the legislative body for a moment, and I want to talk about a major donation that was made. And so this could build a community event center at Boise's Warm Springs Golf Course.
Yeah, I'm actually really excited about this. So my Boise Dev co-worker, Margaret Carmel, she actually wrote this story, but basically it's a planned community center / clubhouse that would be on Warm Springs Golf Course. And it would have food and beverage service, a large patio, a golf pro shop. And one of the coolest parts, I think, is that it wouldn't just be for golfers. The center would be open to anyone. So say you're walking on the green belt or maybe hiking in the Boise foothills, you could stop by after for maybe a bite to eat or a drink. And the donation, like you said, is made possible by an anonymous and generous donor. He's forking over or he or she, we don't know, $3.5 million for this center, the donation. The project total would cost $9.6 million. So to pay for the difference, $2 million would come from the Boise's golf course reserves, and then $4.1 million from the city capital fund. But part of the deal is that $4.1 million, it'd be paid back to the city capital fund over a decade from the city's golf reserves. So yeah, I think that's a super exciting project, and that seems fun to me. I love to go hiking, and I'm not really a golfer, but I mean, I'd love to stop by after for lunch or something. So yeah, it's a really exciting project.
So do we know, Gretchen, like, would, because there's a little pro shop at Warm Springs Golf Course right now. So do we know, would it be built in that same location? But I guess also, do they have to raise this few million dollars before they were to move forward? I guess where is this in the sense of it actually becoming a reality?
So I think it's in the pretty early stages. As Boise City Council, they accepted and approved this donation just this week. So as far as construction and how far off, it does seem to be a little bit in the future. But also, part of construction, they'd have to slightly reconfigure the golf course. So that's something too. But I think people would probably have to, we'll have to wait a little bit to see exactly the timeline of this project when it will actually become a reality.
Okay. And Will, before we head into a break, I want to talk about health officials throughout our region looking for solutions to mental health issues. Can you talk to us about this? Because we do know that, you know, the Mountain West has really high rates of suicide.
Yeah, sure. So just for some quick context, 70% of Idaho residents live in what the federal government designates as a mental health shortage area. I think a lot of people who are looking for counseling right now can probably relate to, you know, long, months-long wait lists at times to find therapy. And one solution that people are looking into that's really interesting is called the Counseling Compact, which has been enacted in Colorado and Utah. Wyoming's thinking about it. Idaho's not quite doing that yet. And what that would allow is it would make it easier for licensed therapists and psychiatrists in different states to get licensed in another state. Now, for this story, I actually talked to a counselor from Idaho Falls. And that's an area where a lot of people from Wyoming, Montana, and even Utah go for healthcare, but also are looking for mental health care. So it's a real hindrance for someone who's a counselor in Idaho Falls, for instance, to have to turn down patients because it's hard to get a license. It's cumbersome. It's hard to get multiple licenses. And in the world of virtual therapy, it's even more important. And I think about Idaho, you know, a lot of your big metro areas, you know, I feel like Moscow, Boise, Coeur d'Alene, right? They're all connected to another state in some way. So I think one solution people are looking into beyond just, hey, let's fund more grants, let's get more counselors who are interested in the field, let's also increase our pool by just allowing counselors to, you know, look across borders for more patients.
Okay. So I want to head back to the State House because education was a big topic of discussion this past week. And Sadie, yesterday here on our program, we did go pretty in depth with school choice, but I do know that maybe some folks may not be fully up to date on this. So can you fill us in on a school choice bill that cleared its first hurdle this week?
Yes. So that would be the Education Freedom Act, or the Freedom in Education Savings Account Program, which is sponsored by Senator Tammy Nichols of Middleton. And it was also written in partnership with the Idaho Freedom Foundation's Anna Miller. And essentially what it would do is it would pull $20 million to create a universal savings account, education savings account program. And that would allocate $5,950 per child scholarships to any qualifying family, which basically means any family with a student in the K-12 system who goes to private school. And so they could use that money to pay for private school tuition or related costs like textbooks, uniforms, counseling, things like that. And it's based on a similar legislation out of Arizona. And it's been something that these conservative lawmakers have been pushing for quite a while. There was a similar bill that was killed in the House Education Committee last year. And it's the education savings accounts are something that are super divisive in education circles. On one hand, you have hardline conservatives who've been pushing for these for a long time. And on the other side, you have public school education organizations like the Idaho School Boards Association or the Idaho Education Association who stand firmly against them. And in committee, we had the only dissenting vote. And I should say here, too, that the bill was just introduced and sent to print. So it hasn't had a full hearing yet. But mm-hmm. Senator Janie Ward Engelking out of Boise, who's a Democrat, she was the only one to vote against sending the bill to print. And she said that she believed that it is unconstitutional based on Idaho's Blaine Amendment, which is a clause of the Constitution that disallows public funds to go to any sort of religious entity, including religious schools. And she also had concerns about accountability, losing accountability for those dollars, and was concerned that it would pull funding from public schools and cause issues in our public school districts. So as I said, it's just gone to print and they haven't heard testimony or had a hearing on the actual legislation. But based on what has already happened in committee and the conversations that have happened, it sets the stage for a pretty contentious discussion in the future.
Uh-huh. And Scott, Sadie mentioned Arizona. Now, a lot of opponents of school choice, folks who are not in favor of school choice, look to Arizona actually as an example of why school choice is not a good option for Idaho. And you wrote about this recently. So can you talk about this? Because it does seem that Arizona is kind of that model for what could potentially happen here.
Right. And in November, an institute called the Grand Canyon Institute in Arizona analyzed the zip code distribution of the applicants to Arizona's universal education savings accounts. And they found some really interesting things. Overall, high-income zip codes are overrepresented and low-income zip codes are underrepresented. So about 20% of the people who applied for vouchers came from zip codes that had incomes, median incomes of more than $100,000. Almost half came from zip codes that had median household incomes of $80,000 or more. So almost half of the applicants came from high income areas, and low income zip codes were underrepresented. They represented only 32% of the applicants under 60,000 income, but they represent 11% of the total applicants. Another thing the study found was 80% of the applicants were not in public school already. So meaning that these students were either already in private schools being homeschooled or they were just entering the schooling. One of the arguments in favor of vouchers is that it rescues, quote unquote, rescues students from failing schools. But if you figure that 80% of the applicants in Arizona were not in public school to begin with, that puts a hole in that theory. And we saw the same thing in Indiana. Indiana has similar numbers or even more stark. Of the 44,000 students in private schools using vouchers in Indiana, only 421 of those students had moved from a failing public school. So again, 400 out of 44,000 of voucher recipients in Indiana were in failing schools. And so some of these studies are putting holes in this theory. The Arizona study, 3.5% of all applicants came from zip codes that did not qualify for a previous version of the vouchers for qualifying for failing schools. So 3.5%, again, you're talking small numbers that are supposedly supposed to be the biggest beneficiaries are turning out to not be in these other programs.
Well, and my understanding, Scott, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, is that in Idaho, what's been introduced is like this universal voucher system, right? So as Sadie mentioned, if you have a child who is in the K-12 system, whether that's public, private, homeschool, you would qualify for this almost $6,000 voucher per child. And yet, and we discussed this on our program yesterday, was that we have 15,000 plus students in Idaho that go to private schools. They're not accounted for in our system right now, right? There's no money going to them. So then there's the question of, which many folks, I think many opponents have of this, is, well, where is the oversight on that? And also, where is the money to be able to give to these students who are currently not accounted for, let alone students that are homeschooled?
Right. And ostensibly, these students, many of these students, if not most of these students who are already attending private school, obviously have the means to do so. And so now, if they are eligible for a $6,000 subsidy, that perhaps they don't necessarily need it. Well, now you're paying, it's a subsidy for the wealthy, essentially.
Mm-hmm. So, Clark, I want to stay with education right now, but I want to go to elections, because what's going on at the State House when it comes to dates for school elections?
Yeah, this is another big change that's under consideration right now. There are actually two different bills that would change the days that local school districts are allowed to run their elections for bond issues and supplemental levies. Right now, in Idaho law, there are just 4 days of the year where school districts can run an election. You've got your traditional May and November election that everybody already knows about. And then in addition to that, there's one date in March and one date in August when your school districts can run your bond issues, your supplemental levies. And what both of these new bills would do, one's actually a property tax bill and the other is an elections bill, but both bills would have the effect of getting rid of the March and the August levy and bond issue election dates for schools. This is something that Republicans have been pushing for several years. And I went back to some of the reporting that Idaho Education News had done. And their reporter, Kevin Richard, who I know is a friend of the show, had looked at 6 years worth of election data from school districts. And he found that the March date, which is one of the dates that these new bills would eliminate, the March date was actually the most popular date for local school district officials to run their bonds and levies. And a big reason why, when he talked to the Idaho School Boards Association, had to do with timing and salaries and benefits. The state and the school districts have to issue teacher contracts on June 1st every year. And salaries and benefits are the biggest part of their budget every year. And so if they're unsure about how much money is going to be available, or if they're short, they're able to run a supplemental levy in March, have that decision in from voters, and have the money available in time to issue the teacher contracts. They say the other dates are too late. Even the May date, which is like the third week of May, they said that's too late to be able to have that assurance to move forward with issuing the teacher contracts. And so it's about timing. It's about salaries and benefits. And these two new bills would get rid of it. And when you talk to the supporters of the new bills, they say that it's about making it more obvious to citizens of Idaho when elections are going to be. They say that turnout will increase because turnout at school bond and levy elections is historically lower than turnout for general elections, city council elections, legislative elections, things of that nature. But some of the school organizations are saying this could really hurt our ability to budget and know just exactly how much we're going to have available when we begin ramping up and planning for the upcoming school year ahead. And so those bills were just introduced, so they're kind of at the beginning of their legislative journey. But those are something that we're going to be watching for sure. And I know that Scott and Sadie also have been keeping tabs on those bills as well.
Mm-hmm. And Gretchen, before we go to break, we might soon see a casino in the Mountain Home area.
That's right. This is another story that Margaret Carmel has been following. So this is a proposal from the Shoshone Bannock tribe, and they've already been working on this for more than a decade. And before this could ever become a reality, it has to go through like a host of more of approvals, including the Department of the Interior. The governor would need to sign off, and the city of Mountain Home. But they had an open house in January, the Shoshone Bannock tribe did. And that was the first chance for people who live in the area to kind of ask questions about this. And so they had posters kind of presenting the pros to this casino, which they say would bring over 1,000 jobs, and it'd be a huge investment in the community. But also, a lot of people who liked the idea, they liked the idea of the entertainment and, of course, the jobs. But there was also people who were concerned about, you know, addiction, of course, people developing a gambling addiction. Also, we asked the Mountain Home Sheriff, Sheriff Hollenshed. He was there in attendance, and Margaret asked him, you know, what do you think about this? And he was like, well, it's a little above my pay grade, but if it ever does happen, you know, he'll obviously be very involved. So it's a long ways off, but if it does happen, I mean, it'll be huge.
Oh, absolutely. No question about that. So Clark and Scott, I know that you both wrote about this next issue, and that's the fact that the Idaho House Majority Leader wants to change oversight of a nonpartisan watchdog group. So Clark, I want to begin with you. Can you first tell us what this group is and how it currently works, and I guess what could change?
Yeah, absolutely. So the group we're talking about is the Office of Performance Evaluations. It's kind of the Idaho Legislature's independent, nonpartisan, really watchdog agency. And we're probably going to get into mentioning several different names and committee names. And it gets a little bit confusing, but I think the main thing to keep in mind that this is an independent, nonpartisan agency, and they're talking about changing the oversight and accountability of that agency to go before a different group that's controlled by Republicans and controlled by the Republican majority leadership. There are Democrats on that group, but the oversight is going from a completely, truly bipartisan group that the legislature would do away with if this bill passes, and would go to a different committee that has more Republicans on it than Democrats. And this is the Office of Performance of Evaluations has done a number of interesting reports over the last few years, independent evaluations looking at different state agencies and how effective they are and whether or not they're working. And so some of the examples of the reports that this group have produced just over the last 3 years included a report that looked at like 164 different state tax exemptions that are on the books. The report found that none of these exemptions expire, and there's no regular process to review these exemptions to see if we're still getting what we hoped to get out of the exemptions. Another report that this group had looked at was the age and state and condition of our school facilities. It found millions and millions and millions of dollars worth of deferred maintenance and really crumbling school facilities in some buildings across the state. The group has also looked at Medicaid reimbursement rates and Medicaid rates, and kind of about some of the struggles that the Idaho legislature has had overseeing the Medicaid program. And so the questions that are arising are, if the oversight of this independent watchdog agency changes, and if legislative leaders would be able to appoint the director of this Office of Performance Evaluations, would it or would it not change the independent nature of the way that it looks at different state agencies? But I want to give a minute or two to Scott to talk about this, because I know that he's looked at it closely and has looked at some of the kind of pros and cons with this idea as well.
Yeah. And Scott, because you also spoke with officials in North Carolina, right? Because they made a similar change a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I was able to track down John Turcotte. He was the director of North Carolina's Program Evaluation Division. And a lot of states have these evaluation offices under different types of names. And John Turcotte has been doing evaluations for 50 years in Mississippi, North Carolina, Florida. He set up some of these offices, and he was the longtime director in North Carolina. And he retired a couple of years ago. And the North Carolina legislature, which is also controlled by the Republican Party, similar to Idaho, decided that would be a good time to make that change. And that's what they did, just what Idaho is proposing. They turned it from a nonpartisan or bipartisan office, independent, and they put it under control of what's called the Legislative Council of Government Operations, governmental operations, and they call it GovOps. And so I asked John, how's it been going in North Carolina since they did that? He says, they haven't done a damn thing. They haven't issued a single report. They've had a couple of witch hunt political hearings, but they haven't. They've completely stopped doing these good government audits of programs. And he said that they would do 8 or 9 reports a year, and he estimates his office saved millions of dollars. Like Clark said, looking at inefficiencies or things that are not working, or wasteful spending programs that are not, they're not getting the bang for the buck, and then can go back and get fixed. And it's kind of wonky and insider politics, but these studies are getting used by interim committees and germane committees in the legislature. John Turcotte said that if Idaho does this, it would be a big mistake. Idaho would see what happened in North Carolina, and the same thing would happen, that you just have no more evaluations. And I think that's part of it. I think that's perhaps the reason that the Republicans are making this push, is because they don't want an office, for example, if school vouchers get approved. And then they wouldn't want an independent agency to look at the efficiency and the effectiveness of that program. And some of these audits are indeed critical of state government operations. And so we might see those go away if this is indeed brought under a partisan commission.
Mm. Will, Sunday was the anniversary of truly probably one of the darkest events in Idaho's history, and this was the Bear River Massacre. So quickly, for folks who aren't familiar, can you tell us about that? And then what a Native American tribe is doing right now to restore the land, correct?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I'll try to be quick for listeners who might not know about the Bear River Massacre. And the location is pretty close to the Utah border and near Preston, Idaho. And what it was, this was a site of a winter camp for the Shoshone people. People would come from as far away as Nevada and Wyoming to this area to spend the winter. A lot of times this is the type of place where people would meet their husband or wife in modern terms, so to speak, right? It's a lot of different families and bands of the Shoshone mm-hmm. coming together. And there were conflicts as, you know, people settled west. And unfortunately, the U.S. government decided in 1863 to raid this winter camp, and, you know, it essentially turned into a massacre. And after that, it became part of the West agricultural history. And for generations, this land that was sacred for the Shoshone was an area that was part of agriculture. Well, the Northwestern Band of the Shoshone Nation today, based out of the Pocatello area usually, was able to actually purchase a piece of land that was the site of this Bear River Massacre. Of course, in part to commemorate this, like you said, horrific event in the state mm-hmm. and in American history, but also to actually restore the land back to what it looked like before white settlement. So they're taking out invasive species, they're rerouting streams on the beautiful Bear River. It's such a gorgeous area. And their goal is to make it look like it did before white settlement, and also add a sort of cultural center. And so they made that purchase about 5 years ago. Things are going really well. And there's a lot of hope that, you know, if you come back in a decade, that there will be a cultural center talking about not only this massacre, but also the long and really storied and incredible history of the Shoshone people.
Yeah. So Sadie, how did a New York State high school student get involved in Idaho's abortion controversy?
Yeah, so a New York high school student named Talia Lieber wrote an article, an online article that surveyed 61 colleges and universities across the country asking if they would cover travel expenses for abortion. And this was at the end of August, and kind of as a response to the overturn of Roe v. Wade. And when she talked to the University of Idaho, and when she talked to them, the spokesperson told her that there's a student emergency fund that students can access, grants, small grants of $100 or a couple hundred dollars. For emergencies, like medical emergencies, or if they need food, things like that. And the spokesperson told her, according to the article, that the university doesn't get involved in medical emergencies, but the money theoretically could be used to cover travel expenses or something like that, because they don't verify after the fact where the money goes. Mm. So after this article came out, the University of Idaho kind of went into damage control mode. Do you want me to go into more of that as well?
Really quickly, like what they did to try to backtrack on that.
Yeah, so in September, the U of I president, Scott Green, sent an email to lawmakers who had kind of caught wind of the article. And he denied the claim that the University of Idaho was providing any funds for abortion or abortion-related expenses. And that's significant because of the No Public Funds for Abortion Act. So the university is barred from spending money on abortion or abortion-related expenses. And so there was an email that had circled through some circles of lawmakers that was who were concerned that the University of Idaho was providing money for those abortion-related expenses. So Scott Green countered that with this email that he sent out to legislators and also countered it with the memo that went nationally viral in September that President Biden responded to that said that university officials and staff members should not counsel students on abortion and should be careful about what they say regarding abortion on campus.
Okay, appreciate the update on that. So Clark, property taxes, big issue in the state house. And there have been some property tax bills introduced in the legislature.
Yeah, things really picked up yesterday, Gemma. Property tax relief is one of the top issues that's on Idahoans' minds right now. We actually found that out from a Boise State University public policy survey that was released a little earlier this legislative session. And so, yeah, three brand new property tax bills were introduced yesterday in the House Revenue and Tax Committee, and they're coming from three prominent Republicans, and they each take a different approach at attempting to solve the same problem, which is reducing the amount of money that Idahoans pay in property taxes. One of the bills from Senator Scott Groh, he's the co-chairman of JFAC. His bill would take sales tax money, about 4.5% of the sales tax collections every year from the state, and put that directly towards reducing the amount of property taxes that Idaho primary homeowners pay. So if it's something that's rented out or if it's not owner occupied, it wouldn't apply to you. But if it's your home you're living in, it would be designed to reduce the amount of money that you owe on your property taxes. It wouldn't affect the amount that goes to local taxing districts or anything like that. So Groh's proposal uses sales tax money. Representative Bruce Skog has a different bill, and what he hopes to do is reinstate the homeowner's property tax exemption index. This is something that existed before for 10 years in Idaho and was taken off the books in 2016. After that happened, Skog said that commercial property and non-homeowner property enjoyed tax reductions while our homeowner's property taxes went up. So he would restore that index. And then House Speaker Mike Moyle has the most complicated bill of the three. It's like 21 pages long, but Speaker Moyle's bill would put $300 million and give it to local school districts every year with the idea that they would pay down their bonds and their levies. This also gets into the bond and levy elections that we talked about before the last commercial break. So Speaker Moyle's bill would give the school districts this money to pay down their bonds and levies, but it would also eliminate those two election dates in March and August that they have at their disposal. So these bills are brand new. They're just starting their legislative process. But this is something that a lot of Idahoans have been asking for years, and it hasn't happened. The last 3 years, we've done income tax reductions, and this is the big swing at taking on property taxes. So we'll see if any of these bills advance or get the support, but it's kind of off and running at this point, Gemma.
Okay. Scott, let's talk about Avamore. This is a subdivision kind of outside of the city of Eagle. They've been wanting to be annexed into the city, and there's lots of controversy around this. So what is the latest in regards to that?
Yeah, this is your bi-weekly update on Avamore.
Yeah.
a massive planned community about 5.5 miles northeast of Eagle, the city of Eagle, the northeast most tip of corner of Eagle. It's planned for 8,800 houses, 23,000 people, And they want to annex into Eagle. The Planning and Zoning Commission finished their hearing testimony this week, and they ruled, they voted 3-1 to recommend not annexing Evermore into the city of Eagle. Now, this is, of course, not the end. It is a recommendation to city council. So now it will go before city council for another round of hearings. And I would say that probably most people expect Eagle city council members to approve annexation. But we'll see. You know, the testimony has been overwhelmingly against annexation over cost concerns to provide services, traffic concerns, and all that sort of stuff. But they haven't scheduled it quite yet, but the next step will be to go before Eagle City Council for more testimony and a final decision on whether to annex or not this massive planned community.
Gretchen, I've only got about 2 minutes left, but I quickly want to talk about what's going on at the legislature in regards to them wanting to control streets around the State House. And this is kind of tied into the city of Boise, how they've been looking at certain streets and wanting to make them two ways.
Sure. So this is Representative Joe Palmer's bill. And basically, it would give the legislature control of the streets that surround the Capitol. And the reason for this is because of safety, he says. And this was going to go to the House floor this week, but it got pushed back to next week. And so basically, any changes to the roads around the Capitol for more than a week, it would require the approval of the governor, the State Capitol Commission, and leaders of the Idaho legislature. And of course, this would likely impact what the city of Boise, ACHD, and CCDC are talking about, which is converting 5th and 6th streets to two-way traffic. So 6th Street is one of those that surrounds the Capitol. So that would impact this. So I'm not sure what's going to happen with that, but that's going to go to the House floor next week.
Okay. I think it's going to be interesting to see how that all plays out, because the city of Boise has long been talking about making these changes to 5th and 6th Street. With that said, I want to thank all of you for your time today. I know how busy all of you are, so really appreciate your time. We've been talking with Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman, Gretchen Parsons, managing editor with BoiseDev.com, Sadie Dittenberg, reporter with Idaho Ed News, and Will Walkie, reporter for the Mountain West News Bureau and Wyoming Public Radio. Have a great weekend, everyone. Appreciate your time.
Thanks. Have a great weekend.
Bye. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Race might be a hot topic right now, but for so many of us, talking about race is nothing new. On the Code Switch podcast from NPR, we go beyond the headlines and we go deep. Listen now.